Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast of Hemingway greatness. Today we're talking about part 5, chapter thing. Oh dear. I should probably open up the Reddit page before I start recording. That would be preferable. How are you today? Anyway, good? That's good. Part 5, chapter 2. Is Levin's self-doubt endearing or unattractive? I am Norwegian quoted me on yesterday's episode saying religious talk bores me. Mwahahaha. You'll never escape it as long as I'm here. Kierkegaard was super religious. How he approached religion is a little convoluted, but you can basically sum it up as a leap of faith. That leap being an expression of free will and not a reasoned conclusion. Sorry. I hope that's not offensive that I just get disinterested in the whole religious talk thing. I like Kierkegaard. I read him as like more like existential, but I know he's like super religious. I suppose he was having existential crises within his religion or about his religion. But the resolve of it was sort of to fall back into it via a whole bunch of writing. What one did I read by him? Fear and Trembling? Is that him? Or is that... Yeah, that's him, isn't it? Is Levin's self-doubt endearing or unattractive? I'm Norwegian says, it's very unattractive. If he did it once, sure. But Levin is compulsively begging for reassurance. Being that insecure is just awkward for everyone involved. Yeah, I completely agree. Swim said the moment fishy said, since Tolstoy was becoming increasingly interested in God, faith, and religion around this time, I predict Anna is going to become much more bored as we go forward in Anna Karenina. Hemingway recommended this book to the young writer, I believe, because of the writing, not because of the subjects that it's written about. I think that is important to keep in mind. The writing is very clean, very good. Tolstoy is so accessible. You write these huge epic books that go for 1,000 pages, but somehow it feels accessible. You reckon I'm going to be increasingly bored as we go forward? I don't know. I don't think Tolstoy doesn't seem to harp on about any one thing too much. Like, I'm not like completely bored by anything vaguely religious. Don't get me wrong. Like, I think there's a lot to be interested in, and it's all questions of philosophy and spirituality, and I'm interested in that, but I can zone out a bit, and sometimes it loses my interest a bit. I'm Norwegian says, luckily there are a bunch of other characters to balance things out. Every time I've been starting to get sick of a character or a subplot, perspectives have changed, so the book always feels fresh. I know this is the Hemingway List, but I've never read anything of Hemingway's except the Wikipedia page of The Man and the Sea, and I don't know anything about being an author. The ideas are always going to interest me more than... I knew nothing going into Anna Karenina, but I'm really glad Tolstoy happened to veer into exactly the things I'm interested in. Interesting. I also have never read anything by Hemingway, but I often quote him as being my favourite writer, which is really weird that my favourite author as an author is an author that I've never read. But Hemingway was quoted of saying not to compete with anyone, no, what was it? Don't compete with anyone except for yourself. No, what was his quote? It's like only compete with dead authors or something like that. Only compare yourself to dead authors, which is like to say don't compare yourself to your contemporaries. Like, if you're going to try to measure up to someone, like, try to measure up to the greats and just compete with them, but don't compete with people who are living today, which I think is cool. And I kind of went one further and thought, like, it's cool to compete with yourself, but to compete with this, to try to compete with an ideal of the perfect writer or the greatest writer, but to never actually know what that is. It's like setting a bar way above what you think you could achieve and then trying to achieve that. That's kind of my thing with Hemingway. I don't know if that made any sense, but it makes sense to me. One day I will read some of his stuff. I've read like the odd page here and there, so I'm familiar with his style, but I've never actually read one of his books. Yeah, there are other characters to balance things out. Correct. Yes, agreed. It does feel sometimes a little crowbarred in when he talks about either political things or religious things, like, oh, Levin, I hear you're going to get married. I thought I'd just knock on your door. Oh, how are you, side character? Good. I was just thinking about religion. And then they have a conversation about religion, and it's just like, that character just wasn't there, and then they were there to talk about one specific political or religious thing, and then they weren't there again. And it's just like, that had nothing to do with the plot. That character just kind of like popped his head in and then popped his head back out. I don't know. That's happened multiple times in this book and in, it happens a bit in War and Peace too, but I've noticed it more in Anna Karenina. And it does feel very crowbarred in. But he doesn't do it too much. The conversations are fairly short, one or two pages, and they're done. So, I can cope. Swim said the mum fish, he said, "Purr, Kitty." "You're mad," Kitty said, flushing with vexation. "I too find Levin annoying and irritating, as does the princess. My God, he's moody." He's just too, what's the word? He's got no confidence. And it's a bit self-sabotaging, you know? Like, to just be about to get married and then to just get it in your head like, "Oh my God, I think she doesn't love me. I think she's only doing it because she feels like she has to. Oh, I better go ask her." And then you go and ask her, and then what's she gonna think? Like, it's just crazy. And it's not kind either to do that to the other person, I think. Just bringing up all this doubt and worry out of nowhere, just inventing it. Not petty is not the word, but yeah, it's not a good look. Levin, you got to get your shit sorted out, buddy. Chapter 3 of the book, which I'm just going to dive into because it's a bit hard to talk because I've got some kind of chest thing going on where I feel like I'm always short of breath because of this this cold I've got. A crowd of people, mostly women, had assembled outside the church, which was brightly lit up for the wedding. Those who had arrived too late to get into the middle of the throng pressed round the windows, pushing and disputing and trying to peer in between the bars. More than 20 carriages had already been ranged along the street by the mounted police. A police officer, unmindful of the frost, stood at the entrance looking brilliant in his blue uniform. More carriages kept driving up, and now ladies with flowers in their hair got out, holding up their trains, or men appeared who doffed their military caps or black hats as they entered the church. Inside the building, the candles in both chandeliers were already lit, as well as the candles in front of the icons. The golden glitter on the crimson background of the iconostasis, the gilt ornaments of the icons, the silver of the chandeliers and the candlesticks, the flagstones of the floor, the mats, the banners above the choir, the steps of the ambo, the ancient books black with age, the cassocks and surplices were all inundated with light. On the right of the well-heated church, a staid, though animated, conversation was going on amidst the swallowtails, coats, white ties, uniforms, brocades, velvets and satins, hair, flowers, bare shoulders and arms, and long gloves, the sound of which re-echoed strangely from the high dome above. Every time the door creaked, everyone turned around, expecting to see the bride and bridegroom enter. But the door had opened more than 10 times, and each time it turned out to be a guest, who had been detained and now joined the crowd on the right, or a spectator who had managed to deceive or soften the heart of the police officer who had joined the throng of strangers on the left. And both relatives and spectators had passed through every phase of anticipation. At first they expected the bride and the bridegroom to enter at any moment and attached no importance to the delay. Then they turned more and more often towards the door, wondering whether anything had happened. At length the delay became awkward, and the friends and relatives tried to look as if they were not thinking about the bride and the bridegroom, but were absorbed in their conversations. The archdeacon, as if to draw attention to the value of his time, coughed impatiently, making the windows vibrate. From the choir, growing weary of waiting, came the sound of voices being tried and the blowing of noses. The priest continually sent a chanter of deacon to see whether the bridegroom had arrived, and he himself, in his purple surplice with the embroidered girdle, went with increasing frequency to the side door in expectation of the bridegroom. At last, one of the ladies looked at her watch and said, "Well, this is strange." And then all the guests became restless and expressed their surprise and dissatisfaction aloud. The best man went to find out what had occurred. All this while Kitty, long since ready in her white dress, long veil, and crown of orange blossoms, stood with an old lady who was to accompany her and her sister, the Princess Lvova, at a window of the ballroom at the Shcherbatskys', for the last half hour, vainly expecting her best man to come and announce that the bridegroom had reached the church. Levin, meanwhile, in trousers but without coat or waistcoat, was pacing up and down his room, perpetually putting his head out at the door and glancing up the corridor. But in the corridor there was nobody. And in despair, he returned and addressed Oblonsky, who was quietly smoking. "Was ever a man in such a terribly idiotic position?" he demanded. "Yes, it is stupid," Oblonsky concurred with a soothing smile. "But don't worry, I'll be here in a minute. It'll be here in a minute." "Oh, how can I help it?" said Levin with suppressed fury. "And these idiotic open waistcoats, it's impossible." He glanced at his crumpled shirt front. "And suppose the things have already gone to the station," he exclaimed in despair. "Then you'll have to wear mine. I ought to have done that long ago." "It is better not to look ridiculous. Wait, it will all shape itself." The fact of the matter was that when Levin told his old servant Kuzma to get his things ready, Kuzma had duly brought his dress coat, waistcoat, and what else he considered necessary. "But the shirt?" Levin exclaimed. "You've got it on," Kuzma replied with a quiet smile. He had not thought of leaving out a clean shirt, and having been told to pack everything and send it to the Shcherbatskys', whence they were to start that evening, he had done so and had left out only the dress suit. The shirt Levin had been wearing since the morning was crumpled and quite unfit to wear with the fashionable low-cut waistcoat. It was too far to send to the Shcherbatskys', so they sent out to buy one, but as it was Sunday, all the shops had been closed early. They sent for one of Oblonsky's, but it was much too wide and too short. They were obliged to send to the Shcherbatskys' after all, and the things had to be unpacked. Meantime, in the church, everyone was waiting for the bridegroom, while he was pacing up and down like a caged beast, looking despairingly along the corridor, remembering all he had said to Kitty and wondering what she must be thinking now. At last the guilty Kuzma, quite out of breath, rushed in with the shirt. "Only just in time, they were hoisting the trunk into the cart," he gasped. 3 minutes later, Levin, not looking at the clock to avoid upsetting himself still more, ran as fast as he could down the corridor. "That won't help matters," remarked Oblonsky, smiling, and following without haste. "It will all shape itself, I assure you." All right, there we go, another chapter, Dunsky. Have your say about that one at the subreddit. Thanks for listening. I will see you tomorrow.